When our study last time, we didn't finish out on our notes. We had come to the question of why we have a Bible. And I kind of rushed a couple of points there that we're going to go back to pick up where we kind of left off. We were dealing last time with the fact that everybody has a perspective about everything. Basically, what that means is you have an opinion about everything that is developed off of the way you look at whatever it is your opinion's about in relation to the rest of your life issues. Because in any perspective, there are issues that are more important than others. And so a lot of times we're dealing with stuff out here on the edges and we don't even think about it. We just do it. But when it comes down to the issue of a biblical perspective, we have to be aware that there are a lot of things that we have to decide where we're going to park in relation to the issues and events of our lives. And what we were trying to get across last time was that we have a need. It's probably lifelong in terms of being willing to adjust our perspective so that it mirrors God's. I use the term agape as the word that describes His value system. And that's at the heart of anybody's perspective, is what they value. What we consider to be valuable and what we consider to be true are the two issues of life. The value thing is objective. It sets our agenda. It tells us what we need to chase, if you want to use that terminology. And the issue of whether true or not has to do with the principles that we're going to employ in order to achieve those objectives. So that if we love something, we're going to try to achieve whatever it is we love by certain principles, and those are the love faith issues in the scriptures when we adopt a biblical perspective. But we come into the world already messed up, if you want to go to Romans 5, and we're in a culture and we're in a family and we're in a setting. All of those things have to do with how we adjust early on to the things that are going on. And as little tiny children, we grow up developing these decisions that we're making about what's important and what's true. But aren't any children in here? We're all adults, so we have to do some thinking about what's really valuable and what's really true. And invariably, I hear on the television people saying, you know, that there's a tornado that goes through and wipes out a whole town, or there's a huge fire, burns everybody's house. Invariably, somebody's going to say, oh, that's just stuff. We've still got our life. We've still got each other. That's what's important. That's a value statement. There are people that don't feel that way. They'd rather have their stuff than their relationships. But you don't usually have those on TV. So when it comes down to developing a perspective that mirrors the values that God operates by, that's why we raised the question last time about the question of why God gave us the Bible. Why do we have a Bible? And so this evening we're going to go into that question a little bit further. We were talking a little bit about the difference between the Bible's perspective on God's production of revelation. And we said there's general revelation, the heaven and the stars and the creation and all the animals and all the people and all the things that happen in the physical realm. And then there's special revelation, which is truth from prophets and apostles and people who are speaking from God, for God, by the inspiration of His Spirit. So this book is special revelation, and the universe that He created is. But anyway, the question of special revelation has a root question, and that's why do we even have one? Why do we have a Bible? And the first part of the answer is because it's a more specific revelation than general. In general revelation, Romans 1, Paul says that there are basically only a couple of things that you can draw conclusions about God on the basis of the general creation. It's interesting that you can't really draw conclusions so much about moral issues. But you can decide, according to Romans chapter 1, that creation is a product of an enormously powerful person because we live in it. And as we go further and further into our experience as 21st century people on the planet, they just sent up a, what, $10 billion telescope so that they could see back to the beginning of time. I don't even know why they say that kind of thing, because the light is supposed to be carrying all the information about the beginning of time past us several light years ago. It's already gone. So whatever they're seeing out there isn't the original beginning. But anyway, he did say that because we cannot escape the law of cause and effect. He didn't say this in Romans about cause and effect, but it's assumed there. Because if there's a creation of a powerful being, he says we're inexcusable in our rejection of trying to operate on the principles that that powerful person would expect us to operate by. And the other thing that you can tell from the creation is that God's a person. It's called the Godhead. But what that means is that God's a personal. And part of that's the logic of impersonal. An impersonal creator wouldn't be a creator in the first place, because he wouldn't have the intelligence to, because intelligence is a part of personality. And the second thing is that impersonal creator would never create persons. Wouldn't even know how. Which would mean they wasn't omniscient, which would mean in God. So, Paul just said in terms of general revelation that those are the two big things you conclude, and it leaves everybody without excuse. Because if we're creatures of a person, then we have a responsibility to him. That's the reason, though, that we have to go to special revelation. Because special revelation is a more specific revelation. It tells us a whole lot of things that creation will not tell us, can't tell us. And Paul claimed in Acts 14:17 that though in the generations gone by God permitted all the nations to go their own ways, it says, and yet he did not leave himself without a witness. In that he did good, gave your rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts of food and gladness. That was in his message to the philosophers in Athens. But you notice how he's arguing that? God didn't leave himself without a witness because of the way he was treating us. He was sending rain, giving us fruitful seasons, making our hearts pleased with food and gladness. So he used that to launch into his sermon on the unknown God. But he also indicates that that witness was pretty general, except that it did concern this matter of goodness. And that raises a host of questions. How can you have goodness and evil in the same creation? Because they are mutually exclusive. If it's good, it can't be evil. If it's evil, it can't be good. And we have a mix, and that's another reason we need special revelation to tell us where this mixed up thing came from. But Paul went on to say that he gave this more specific revelation so that people would perhaps seek God, even though he's not far from us. Of course, the biblical testimony is that no man seeks God on his own. But nonetheless, God did it so that they could if they were so inclined. And he also introduces the issue of coming to repentance in Acts 17. So the issue here is that there is a built-in awareness of right and wrong. And of course, Paul addressed that in Romans when he said that men intuitively know because the law is written on their hearts. And that's how you explain how the nations consistently came up with moral codes. Even though they were many times very wrong, they still had a moral code. Every national group had a moral code. Because God didn't leave our hearts blank when he created us. He wrote certain things, built it in. And in fact, the new covenant that we're going to experience the fullness of someday actually contains the promise that he is going to inscribe on our hearts what's right and good, and then we'll just naturally do it. we don't naturally now because there's too much other stuff already written on our hearts. But the question then is, if the Bible is a more specific revelation, why did God give it to us? What was His motivating principle? Why would God even care if we had a more specific revelation? And the only answer you can give that is, if He was giving a revelation of goodness by giving rain and making your crops fruitful and satisfying your hearts with food and good things, then the issue of goodness is built into that. And that would argue that God gave us the Bible because He cares about us. There isn't any other reason. There's no point in God telling us anything if He doesn't care about what's going to happen to us. The biblical record and human history tells us just how long we'd last if we didn't have a moral code at all. If God didn't say anything about anything, just let us run since Genesis 3. It only took 1,656 years for the race to descend from the Garden of Eden to the chaos of the flood. And God wiped out all of humanity except for 8 people. That's how quickly the issues of sin in the human heart can destroy mankind. If God hadn't have done it, we'd have done it to ourselves eventually. In fact, that's kind of how what's going on in our world today, because people are afraid that we're going to destroy ourselves. We have the capability now with all the nuclear stuff. We know it's not going to end up that way because we have more specific revelation. But even though God gave this general witness of His goodness, there are some exceptionally bad things that happen. And men need to know how to discern the reasons for the reality of this mixed bag of good and bad. And I commented last time, I believe, though I've spoken 3 other times since last time, so I can't even remember what I told y'all when. But anyway, the issue of attributing the wrong actor in a cause and effect universe. In Job chapter 1, we're told that Job was one of the most righteous men on the planet. And then Satan goaded God into allowing him to prove his thesis. God's thesis was that Job would love him in spite of all the goodness that he had shown him. And Satan's was, "You're joking. You take what he's got and he'll curse you to your face." And God said, "No, I won't." And so he let him prove it. And then he came back and God said, "Well, were you able to get him to curse me?" And he said, "Well, it's because you wouldn't let me touch him skin for skin. Everybody will give up everybody else for their own if they get to be spared." And so God gave him the ability to do everything to Job except kill him. And still, Job didn't curse God. So the point that I'm trying to make is, all the way through the book of Job, who's getting the credit for all this bad stuff happening to Job? God is. Who caused it? The devil did. That's what I mean about ascribing the wrong actor. When something happens and people say, "Well, that God did that," and you say, "Well, no, He did that. Well, God allowed it." Well, yeah, God does allow a lot of things, but you can't say He caused it if He's just allowing it. Just stop and think. How many things would take place if God didn't allow anything evil? There wouldn't be any place. There wouldn't be any humans on the planet. If He had to stop us before we did anything evil, we'd all be stopped. That'd be the end of creation of humanity. And that's why God tolerates evil choices and evil actions by other people. And in the middle of it all, He encourages us to believe His promises and let our lives flow from Him and not from our circumstances. But that's where this mixed bag comes from. And the most irritating of the mixed bag thing for me, when I'm watching the news in the evening and the weatherman comes on and he blames all this stuff that's happening on Mother Nature. And I wonder now, how does God feel about being called Mother Nature? They don't want to say God's being kind of rough on us today, so they just say Mother Nature is.
Amen. got worse, though.
Oh, yeah. There's lots worse that men have done to God than that, but nonetheless. So, the bottom line then is that we have special revelation because God does genuinely care about us. He cares about what happens to us. He cares about the quality of our experiences. He cares about whether we're going to inherit eternal life or not. He cares about those things. That's the only reason he would have told us all the things he's told us. Otherwise, he could have just let us go. But there was a period in human history that lasted 2.5 millennia, 2,500 years, where the human race didn't have what we call a Bible as we know it. Moses didn't start writing Genesis until about 2,500 years after creation, according to the chronology that's given in the genealogies of Genesis 5 and 10. So what did all those people do? Did God just say, well, we'll just write off the first 2,500 years and then we'll just start telling people what they need to believe and how they need to operate and all that kind of thing?
No.
No? He didn't say that. So the question is, well, what did they have? Because they didn't have what we have as a written Bible, a written revelation from God inspired by His Spirit so that the words are trustworthy, the concepts are trustworthy, the truth is true, and we can depend on it and live by faith. So what did they have? Well, they were not left without divine revelation during that time. Just because they didn't have a written Bible doesn't mean that God wasn't communicating information to them, and we know that how. Who was the first prophet? Enoch. When did he live?
Before the flood.
Yeah, he lived about 2,000 years before Moses started writing Genesis. So, God didn't leave himself without vehicles of information for the generations that were being born and living on the earth. And in fact, even his command to Noah to build that ark out in the middle of everybody's front yard vision, he gave him a message because it says that he preached for 120 years while he was building the boat. That nobody believed him is beside the point. God did not leave himself without a revelation. And that's why I printed up this stuff. Yes?
What about just passing along, like, you know, the stories of when the angels and Jesus visited Abraham, you know, those early things that God appeared to people. Were they written down, or do you think they just passed that on?
Moses actually mentions a few written records that he got some information from, so they did have writing. How they did it, or what, we're left kind of in the dark because the flood wiped out all of the pre-flood history stuff, so we just don't know. But we do know that they had prophets. We do know Noah preached. We do know a lot of things about what they knew. And so the issue there is that men were not left without divine revelation during that time. They just didn't have what we have in a collection of inspired writings that is this thick. It takes us a whole year to read it if we stay on target.
Couldn't it also be Adam killing Cain and Abel?
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. Yes. It had parents telling their children stuff that they knew. But there's a huge problem there, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But anyway, in Hebrews 1:1 it says, God spoke to our fathers in ancient times by many ways and in many utterances. So there was revelation going on. And keep this in mind, whether the skeptics believe it or not, men before the flood lived an average of an average of over 900 years each. So that almost 2 millennia could go by and there would just be 2 generations of human beings. And those generations weren't just sitting around twiddling their thumbs. They were learning things and passing it on to their children, and their children were growing up and living 800, 900 years. And so there was a lot of advantage to the longevity of their lifetimes because they learned a lot of things. And quite frankly, I think they were a lot smarter than we are in terms of what they had to use, because our brains have been affected by the fall and by the fact that our bodies are now only going to live 70, 80, 90 years, depending on certain physical things. But by the time Moses wrote Psalm 90, the average lifespan was 70 years, or if by reason of strength, 80. So it went from almost, well, from 900 years down to 70, and it did it in great big gap, kind of collapsing. After the flood, it began to collapse, so that even when Abraham died at 175, that was unusual. Isaac didn't live that long, and Jacob says he only lived 147. So, but men were given a lot of special information, and as Bonnie pointed out, men were passing it on from father to son during that period of time. And the problem is that though Genesis 4:26 talks of a time when the flood, before the flood, when men began to call on the name Yahweh, that was during the time when Enoch was a prophet on the earth. And you all know that Enoch died as a child. He was only 365. But it was apparently during the period of time when his prophetic voice was being heard that people began to call on Elohim as Yahweh. Now, that wasn't a common thing, but that's what Genesis 4:26 actually says. When it says they began to call on the name of the Lord, in your King James or New American Standard, the word L-O-R-D, if the L and the O and the R and the D are all capital letters, even though the O, R, D are smaller than the L, if they're capital letters, that's a translation of the name Yahweh. And if they're just capital L and then small O, small R, small D, that's Adonai. It's a whole different concept. So, early in Genesis, long before Moses started writing Genesis, there was a period of apparent some form of revival, but it didn't last because they all were drowned in the flood if they didn't die before the flood came. But the interesting thing about creation is that it declares the infinity of God, and that's an indisputable reality because creation is a giant creation metaphor for infinity. We can't even think in terms of infinity. When you think of infinity, you're supposed to think of no boundaries. But when I think of no boundaries, I run them out to where the boundaries are, and then I just push them a little further. That's the only way I can think of infinity. Infinity is a concept that's just beyond us. And the reason it's beyond us is because we're creatures. Creatures weren't designed to be able to conceive of that attribute of God being infinite. But the creation is the creation metaphor for that because it's so huge. I have some more to say about that in our studies in the Gospel of John on Sunday morning, but when I asked the Google to tell me how old is the universe, the smallest number I got was 3,000 light years in age. And then some said maybe 7,000 light years. You can't even think in those terms. The sun is 92 million plus miles from the earth. It takes 8 minutes for the light to get here. So how long is a light minute? That's about 11 million miles. That's how far light will travel in a minute. 11 million miles. Well, how far will light travel in a light year? And then you multiply it by thousands of light years. That's why I said creation is the creation metaphor for the infinity that we can't really conceive of. But our God is infinite. He's the only uncreated existence. So, one of the most interesting comments in the New Testament about that Old Testament era is the book of Jude, verses 14 and 15. Because it says that Jude, in verses 14 and 15, Jude says that Enoch said, I saw the Lord coming with 10,000s of his holy ones to execute wrath upon the ungodly for all the ungodly things they did. And he uses the word ungodly about 4 or 5 times in 2 verses. But the vision of Enoch seeing the Lord coming with 10,000s of his holy ones is not a first judgment thing. It's not a flood judgment vision. It's a second coming vision. Nobody saw any 10,000s of angels coming in the raindrops of the flood. But the scriptures are full of the fact that there are going to be a grand host of the armies of heaven following Jesus when he comes back in the second coming. So Jude tells us that Enoch was a prophet of the second coming. Okay? Now that's where we come to this. The issues that are on this chart that I've given you are the symbols of what is known as the zodiac, and it is the heart of what they call astrology, and it's a perverted thing now, but it wasn't always so. According to Josephus, who was a Jewish military man in the Roman armies, but was also a historian and wrote 2 books on Jewish history, he said that the symbols in the zodiac were created by Seth in order to pass on his theological understanding. And he developed his theological understanding according to the 12 houses of the zodiac. That's where the main constellations of the zodiac come from. And Josephus, for whatever source he had for that, claimed that it was Seth that did that. Well, Seth was the godly replacement for Abel, because the ungodly Cain had killed Abel. And so Seth began to be a force for truth in his early part of his generation. And as Bonnie said, when we were talking about fathers passing this information that they knew down to their offspring, Seth came up with this as kind of a mnemonic device, where if you could think your way through the heavenly constellations, you could think your way through the theology of God, because it's revealed there. Not in the kind of pictures that are drawn, but in terms of association. And we'll get to the one of the clearest here on this left-hand side of your page in just a minute. But it's an interesting thing that the imagery of the zodiac tells us that men knew an awful lot of the information we have in our Bible. Because these symbols, if you turn your page this way, so that the scorpion is down here on the bottom, and look at the top right up here, just to the right-hand side of center is a woman. That's Virgo. You see it? Top of the circle. Just to the left of her is Leo, the lion. If you go down a quarter of the way, either way, if you come down from Virgo a quarter of the way around, you come to Scorpio. If you go on down, you get to Aquarius, the water bearer. And if you go on up to there, you have Taurus, the bull. Well, with the exception of Scorpio, those are the 4 things that Ezekiel said were given in the faces of the creatures that were revealing the glory of God in Ezekiel 1 and 10. And they were the 4 living creatures' faces in Revelation 4. The problem is the scorpion. But it's not really a problem, because Aquila, who is the eagle, You remember in Ezekiel and in Revelation, it was a lion and a eagle and a bull, or a man and a bull. Maybe not in that order, but those were the four. Well, those are the four corners, if you want to call it that, of the zodiac. So the zodiac had this in pictorial presentation from the time of Seth, and we have it in our Bibles as inspired scripture. That can't be an accident. Now, let's go real quickly to this other picture. If you turn your page where you can see this man standing here. This man's name is Ophiuchus in the terms of the constellation. But notice what he's doing. He's stepping down on this scorpion's head. But the tail is coming around. It's going to get him in the heel. Now, do you remember any story in the Bible where somebody's head gets crushed but the heel of the other person gets wounded? It's a serpent in the garden. But it's not a serpent, it's a scorpion. Why is that? Well, partly because if you step on a snake's head, he cannot bruise your heel. Can't. Got all your weight holding his mouth shut. So in their symbolism, they knew that there was a creature that they could use as a metaphor for scorpions. And by the way, scorpions and serpents are linked in the scriptures. But if you step on a scorpion's head, his tail's going to come around you even if you crush his head. He's still going to get you. Now, I want you to notice what Ophiuchus is doing. What's he got his hands on? His left hand and his right hand. What's he grabbed and held of? A serpent. And why is he grabbing hold of it? What's the serpent after?
He's after the crown.
So here's a serpent who's looking for the sovereignty. And Ophiuchus, who is obviously a pictorial representation of Jesus, because he's the one that's going to crush the head of the serpent and get wounded in the heel in the process. But they're wrestling over who's going to be the king. And isn't that what the Bible tells us Lucifer was going to do? I'm going to raise up my throne above the throne of God. I'm going to be the ruler. And Jesus was identified by God as both Lord and Christ, which means he's going to be the ruler. And of course, the ending of that struggle is that Satan is going to be cast into the lake of fire, and everybody that is there to observe what he looks like when he's there, they're going to say, he's the one that caused all this trouble? And his humiliation will be at its maximum point at that point. Because God's not only going to cast him out of his presence, he's going to cast him in the lake of fire, and then everybody's going to mock him. So you can tell why the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia that did the article on the Zodiac said that the imagery in the Zodiac is very clearly biblical revelation in pictorial form. And that's really true. Even the water bearer, which you can't see except over here, the water bearer is the one who pours out the flowing river of water. Let's see, where is he? Yeah, he's the one that's, he's kneeling down right here on this quarter, right above this second picture. He's kneeling down there and he's spilling his water. And the water's flowing out and there are two sets of fish that are swimming in the stream. And this great big sea monster is threatening their lives. Well, what did Jesus say in the last day of the feast when he stood up and said, if anybody's thirsty, let him come to me and drink, and out of his innermost being will flow rivers of living water? He's the water bearer. So there are all kinds of similarities between what Seth put into what he was teaching his children that are now recorded in inspired scripture. And with this rationale, Seth could not maintain the godly focus of heart and mind in the generations that he was instructing. So he might teach his son the truth, but his son's son might be taught some distortion. And what's the typical what's the typical response of the people of this creation when God gives them something? They begin to worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. So what did they do? Stephen says in Acts, when he was just before they stoned him to death for saying it, he said, you guys were carrying around all of these star gods on your banners when you were in the wilderness, supposed to be servants of Yahweh. You were worshiping the symbols of the zodiac. And of course, the end result in our generation is astrology, where people try to tell you what's going to happen to you if you were born under a certain sign, all that kind of stuff. It's just worshiping and serving the creature rather than the creator. So, the biblical perspective on why we have a Bible is that God loves us, but His love for us is a complex thing, so we'll talk about that next time, perhaps. Any questions about what we've looked at now, Tim?
The river, the water flowing from Water Bear, was it Jeremiah or Ezekiel that the host took and showed him the river flowing from the temple?
There is a vision in Ezekiel where the water is flowing out from under the foundation of the temple, but the further you get away from it, the deeper the river is. So there's an enormous amount of water squishing out through there, but it's the further away you get, the deeper it is.
Yeah, is that a similar revelation of Christ being the river?
Yeah, because the whole issue there is that the water is necessary for our life, and he is the source and the origin of the river of the water of life. And even in the new creation, there's going to be a river of water of life. So all these symbols all dovetail.
So I might be mixing things up, but is the zodiac based on star position, the constellations, and all that?
All the constellations are known. There's 12 major constellations, and there's 4 constellations associated with each house. So there's 48 original constellations.
So was Seth just, he had this vision of what creation was and all that, and what was to come? Was he just making his thoughts match up with what the stars the stars' position to actually display that?
No, they weren't pictorial things.
Okay.
Like, you know, you have the belt of Orion. Well, it's actually a belt.
Right.
Like the Big Dipper looks like a Big Dipper.
Right.
But most of the constellations don't look like anything.
Okay.
They just belong in their house.
Okay, use your imagination.
Well, you didn't have to use imagination because Seth had said. Now, when you think of the lion, think of the fact that God is going to produce a man who's going to rule the earth, and Jesus was the lion of the tribe of Judah, so he was Leo in the theology that Seth knew, and we didn't get that until we got we were way into our Bibles before we got to that.
So did Seth just assign these stars here are going to represent the lion?
Mm-hmm.
Well, even though they don't look like one, he said...
No, he divided the ecliptic into 12 sections, and he said, okay, now, son, when you see this constellation in the heavens, because it had major stars that were identified,
and they
rotated around the ecliptic every year, he said, when you think of Leo, this is what I want you to think of in relation to God.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like I saw an ad for, if you need to go, you can go. But I saw an ad on the TV not too long ago for if you needed to get one of these Advantage plans for Medicare, call this number. And the number was 601-7420. And how do I remember that? Well, because I have a Ford track that's a model 601. And I was 70, and I'm 74 years old, and I got married when I was 20. These are just linking points that help you remember. And that's what Seth did with the constellations. He made linking points for his theological instruction to his children.
How is all that related to the wise men finding Jesus
with the stars? It's highly related because they came from the place where Daniel had spent most of his life in Babylon from the Far East. And they were Zoroastrians. They studied the stars and they knew that Jupiter was the king star and that Venus was connected with the woman. And so when they saw Jupiter and Venus come together, they said, the king of the Jews has been born.
Yeah.
off they went. Took them 4 or 5 months to get there, but. Well, they knew their. These turned into myths. This is where all your mythology from Rome and Greece and all that, these turned into myths, but they didn't start out as myths.